This is The Secret Life of Writers. My name is Gemma Birrell, and I'll be speaking with some of the world's most interesting and visionary writers and creative icons about what they're working on now and how they balance life and art. Today I'm speaking with Australian writer Steve Toltz. Steve's first novel, A Fraction of the Whole, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and the Guardian First Book Award, and his second novel, Quicksand, won the Russell Prize for Humour. Since then, Steve moved to LA, where he's also worked as a screenwriter on shows like No Activity and Guilty Party. Book List called A Fraction of the Whole a deliriously philosophical novel with uproarious ruminations on freedom, the soul, love, death, and the meaning of life. And in a way that applies to all of his work and his new book that we'll talk about today called Here Goes Nothing. Though I should also say that each novel is refreshingly different and groundbreaking. The Irish Times described Here Goes Nothing as a smart social commentary on our fossil fuel guzzling, warmongering, information obsessed, pandemic riddled world. And as the Scotsman said, he writes with remorseless, brilliantly withering contempt. And to my mind, that sits alongside a story and characters that are both affecting and strangely moving, which is a pretty compelling combination.
I wanted to write this kind of third book in this loose trilogy of fear. So my first book is about the fear of death, and the second book was about the fear of life and suffering. And then this book, I wanted to be about the fear of the opinions of other people. And I thought how it'd be kind of interesting to really explore these kind of, you know, how persistent these fears are by seeing what happens if you take kind of death off the table at some point, you know, just sort of see what persists beyond the grave.
Steve, hello. It's so lovely to have the chance to speak today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So how are you going, and how does it feel to have this new book out in the world?
Yeah, it's always odd that when something that you've lived with for so long kind of privately, and I never show pages to anyone during a process of writing. So, you know, literally years and years go by without anyone ever seeing a word. And then a short period of time later, having, you know, people you don't know read it. It's fun.
That's really interesting, actually. So how finished is it when you first show your agent or your editor?
I get it as good as I can possibly get it without burying it in the garden for like 6 months, because that's the ideal. The ideal would be to finish writing it, bury it, and then do something else for 6 months, dig it up, yep, do an edit, bury it again, and then 6 months later, dig it up and then show it to, do a final edit, then show it to.
Yeah, because there is actually something to be said for those fresh eyes after it's been buried in the garden, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I always think of it like a writer needs time, uses time like a painter uses light. Like, I feel like you actually, without time, you actually can't even see what it is that what you've done, which is why, you know, as you go, and you can see that, you know, as you go through the editorial process, which goes through a number of phases, but it's crazy that even say after like three editors have looked at it and the copy editor, you can still find mistakes that nobody saw. So yeah, it takes a lot of eyes and a lot of time.
Yeah, and I guess it's the kind of thing that many years later, if you go back to the book, I bet you still find those things that you might have done differently, which is probably why you don't necessarily want to go back.
Sometimes. Yeah, exactly. It's sort of, you know, because then obviously it's way out of your hands, and that's a depressing moment.
Yeah. So just to set the scene for everyone, I am speaking from Sydney, as you know, just really quite close to the ocean, and it's a beautiful, clear autumn day. So where are you? What is it like there? And can you give us a little bit of detail about your neighbourhood and why you're there?
Okay. I'm in the suburb of Los Feliz in Los Angeles. It's kind of east side LA. I've been here for a number of years, although my time here is coming to an end, I'm coming back to Sydney shortly. And yeah, it's kind of, I guess it's like 5:30 in the afternoon on a kind of, yeah, pretty mild day.
And what's the neighbourhood like? Is it somewhere that you love living? Do you have friendly neighbours? Is it one of those places you don't talk to anyone on the street? What's it like there?
Yeah, I wouldn't say my neighbours are that friendly. They're always calling my landlord to tell me to tell them that I haven't mowed my lawn.
What?
I know, stop it. But other than that, it's a great neighbourhood. It's like a sort of a 6-minute walk to my son's school. There's like, it's a great neighbourhood because there's a bookstore, 2 cinemas, one of which Tarantino just bought. So he's going to turn it into like a cinema where he just shows old films. And there's a Cinematheque at the other cinema. So it's a cool neighbourhood with a great bookstore and lots of cafes and restaurants.
But you're coming back to Sydney, which is great news as well. Now, you've lived in various other places, which, funnily enough, we've known each other for quite a while, but I didn't realise that you'd lived in all of these places. And Montreal, Vancouver, New York, Barcelona and Paris, which is, yes, of course, where we met. And you've been published all over the world. So I'm curious about which of these places did feel more like home, because I feel like there's always a particular city that really kind of sings to us in a different way. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'll always kind of feel at home in Sydney, but, you know, other than Sydney, because that's where I grew up, Barcelona was really my spiritual home. I just had not just the time I had there, but just the kind of the culture and the people and the style of living and the fact that being there was, it just, you know, prioritizes sort of standard of living, which is not defined by, you know, your home, but by the kind of community of culture, like, they don't sort of sequester. You go to a bar and there'll be kids and old people and young people, and we don't get that in many other places. This kind of mix of generations, and it's also like, I guess like Sydney, it's a city on the water. You know, there's a beach there. It's just a great city that I always thought I could retire there.
Yeah. And what about the literary worlds in these different places? Did you feel like there was really a kind of strong difference in the culture of those literary worlds and how they did things?
Well, I feel generally, I've never really been, I don't feel like I've ever been in a literary world that much. I mean, and except certainly not before I was published. And then I kind of, you know, gradually got to know it a little bit. I mean, let's put it this way. I liked being in New York, which is the kind of mecca of the literary, you know, of a literary culture. I like that the least because it sort of really felt like that writing was a career, which is something I don't really like to think about of it that way.
Were you friends with a lot of other writers there?
Yeah, a bunch of writers. And it's nice. I like being friends with writers. I mean, I never met a writer until after I was published. But so I know I do like it. I love meeting writers at writers' festivals and for sure. But the world as a collective, you know, I don't want to know when everyone sort of starts talking about who's published and who's gets the review coverage and who's got this advance and that kind of thing is ill. Yeah.
Yeah. That doesn't sound helpful, does it?
No.
But yeah, just a bit more background. So we met, I don't know how long ago it was now, maybe 15 years ago or something. We were both actually living in Paris at the time.
Yeah.
And I'd tried to convince you to do a reading at Shakespeare and Company, but you weren't very keen. And then
And then we did finally meet when you came and did an event with Five Dials and Hamish Hamilton and their British publisher, who's the wonderful Simon Prosser. I was curious about how you're feeling about doing all of these events now. Are they still kind of grueling for you with this new book coming out, and or have you kind of made friends with the whole idea of events?
Yeah, no, I've made peace with that. I think I was a little hesitant in those early years because, yeah, I'd never, until I kind of got published, I'd never been to a reading. I'd never even heard of readings. I didn't know that that was a thing that people did. And I remember after having got my publisher and they mentioned that I was going to do readings, I remember thinking, gosh, I better go and see one and see what it's like. And I think I went and saw David Mitchell read Cloud Atlas somewhere, and which is, you know, a great book and he's fantastic. But I remember, you know, he was kind of up there and he was doing the voices and I was like, oh, you stand in front of a group of adults and read like you're reading to a child. and he started in the middle of the book and I was like, well, I don't like spoilers, so I don't know about this.
Yeah.
And then so when we met and I got your email saying you would like to do a reading, I was just kind of like, I don't know, what's in it, what's
maybe
in it
not
for me? I've gotten much more comfortable with it. And I do like, I don't really like readings, but I like having conversations, so Q&As and things like that. I'm very happy to do it anytime.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that it's like reading to children. And I think that's, for me, that's a huge pleasure in it. Like, I actually really love that going back to that time when you were read to, because it doesn't happen. I mean, that's probably the only context as an adult that you hear that you're read to again. And
yeah,
it's quite a magical experience, actually. But yeah, talking about publishers, we've just kind of mentioned them briefly, but you obviously have multiple English speaking publishers based in the US and the UK and Australia.
Yeah.
So can you describe a little bit about how you worked on this new book editorially and your others, having those different publishers around the world, especially as I imagine that they have very different opinions and perspectives on your manuscript when you get to that final stage?
Yeah, I mean, each book has had a different kind of process because I also haven't always had the same editors because I've moved in other countries. But generally, they kind of submit their notes and, you know, there's always the clear understanding that the notes can be taken, you know, you can take them or leave them. You know, having worked in other things now, like a little bit in TV, the notes are not take it or leave it, they're take it. You have to do the notes. Whereas, you know, it's always understood that, well, this is my book and so ultimately I can have the final say. But you're dealing with like really well-read, intelligent people who, and I end up always taking about 80% of the notes because they're always generally great. And so at one point, like sometimes the editors will collate the notes and then, you know, just give me the notes in a different font or something so I know who said what.
And I bet you have favourite editors, do you? Like ones that kind of speak to you more? Is that the case? I mean, obviously you won't say which one.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, everyone has a different to take. And, you know, because every book is different and also everybody has a different skill. So one editor might be better at the overall structure and the other one might be better about the minutiae of a scene.
That's so useful, isn't it? Having that those different perspectives. Yeah.
It's incredibly useful. And, so I just kind of, and that's the thing is that, I mean, if I could, I'd have 10 more editors' notes because ultimately, you know, as soon as you read a note, I know whether I agree with it or not, and I've never really agonized over a note. Like I get it, I go, yeah, I agree with that, or no, yeah, it only serves to improve the book.
So basically they give you all of the notes together or do you get them kind of separately?
Well, this time, usually I've had all the notes together. And then this time I just got, I got the notes from the UK and Australia, and sort of I'd sold it to the US a bit later. So I didn't really get any notes from the US this time.
In Australia, you're published by Penguin Random House and for this particular book and your other ones. And also in the US, this time you're published by Melville Press. Is that the first time?
Yeah, that's the first time.
It's such a great press as well. I love what they do. It's really a whole range of really interesting books.
Yeah, and they've done a really beautiful job with the book here.
Yeah, and in the UK, who's the publisher?
Scepter.
Scepter. Okay, fantastic. It's quite interesting to hear that for all of the processes, the editorial process, it's a really positive experience for you.
Yeah, I've only ever had positive experiences editorially. I get kind of... The point where I get confused is things like covers. You know, sometimes you get a cover and you'll be like, that doesn't look great. Or, you know, and then we'll do some back and forth about that.
Did you see lots of versions of this particular cover, which is fantastic, by the way?
No, this is the one they sent. In fact, this time, I have to be honest, this time all three of the covers from the US, the UK and Australia, I liked the first version they sent.
That's good.
Yeah, so it was great. And then there are other things like the audiobook. They sent me some kind of auditions of people reading it. And I can't even listen to it because it's just weird hearing it in somebody else's voice.
But voice is so particular, and it's the same thing with, I imagine, like with an editorial comment. You either agree with it straight away, you like it straight away, or you really don't. And I find that with audiobooks, you know, like, and therefore you can really enjoy it or not, the reading.
Yeah, look, that's true. But the other thing is, like, I don't think anybody doing this would be, because it's so not the voice in my head. That I lived with for 5 years. Yeah, so I just basically generally let them choose that.
Okay, talking about readings, can you give us one, please, Steve, to give us a taste of this brilliant new book, Here Goes Nothing?
Sure. The book is kind of about death and the afterlife, but it's also a love story. And so I'm going to just read a little bit from when Angus Mooney, who's the main character, he who believes kind of nothing, he the first time he goes to the house of the woman he's going to marry, Gracie, who believes way too much. She made her way around the room and lit a number of cheap Virgin Mary candles. Prayer beads hung from nails on the walls, along with an ornate wooden crucifix, a Buddhist prayer wheel, paintings of Shiva and Ganesh, a wooden fish, a pentagram, a yin-yang decal, and a ceramic Star of David. This is a genuinely confusing room. She stayed close beside me as I examined the mismatched iconography. It all had such an odd cumulative effect, making me think of so many things at once that my mind was, for all practical purposes, empty. "What do you believe?" she asked. "Not much." "You must believe in something." "Must I? Did I?" Most of my beliefs were about beliefs, but it was difficult to put them into words. I explained that it had always been wacky to me how belief comes in strange yet predictable pairings, how those who are into angels and ghosts are also often anti-vaxxers convinced the moon landing was faked, just as the individuals who insisted that crop circles were forms of extraterrestrial communication had an equal faith in trickle-down economics. Gracie looked at me curiously, as if she was still waiting for the sound of my voice to reach her ears. "I always believed," I went on, "that nearly all the people on Earth are self-mythologizing liars who only have premonitions in hindsight. If you told them, 'Hey, someone was murdered right here in this house,' it was only then they said, 'Oh yeah, I knew I felt something.' I said I believed that most paranormal occurrences are either too far away to perceive or too close up to focus on, and it's very suspicious that almost nothing supernatural exists at a critical distance." Her eyes seemed to be staring in the direction of my mouth. I said I also believed that life was meaningless but not worthless, and how that distinction had been enough to get me out of bed in the morning. I believed that gullibility was akin to a disability and should be treated accordingly, and that if everything happens for a reason, those reasons are chance, luck, and chaos. The words seemed to be breaking free of my face almost of their own volition. It was very quiet in the room. Gracie edged closer towards me. I said I believed that spontaneous combustion was only evidence that if some fucker is determined to set you on fire and sneak off without being seen, he was certain to do so. That there was no such thing as a reliable human witness, and that all mystical visions were self-generated, which is why Buddhists didn't get visions of Christ, Christians didn't see the Buddha, and there's not a single solitary instance recorded of a rabbi visited by Muhammad. Mainly, I believed that the very people who think they have special powers lack even the ordinary ones.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks so much for that. So as you said, this is a story of Angus Mooney, and I love that name, by the way. It's such a great one. Great. And it's not ruining anything to say that he's murdered early on, and leaves behind his pregnant wife, Gracie, who is also an absolutely unforgettable character. And he finds himself in this kind of, in the afterlife, which is a mundane, strangely mundane hellscape, really, where he has to do things like find work and find somewhere to live and deal with the loss of his actual life and even manage a new relationship. And I found the whole experience of reading it so different to your other novels, but there's also that distinctly Steve Toltz familiarity, which was such a joy to return to. But just a little bit more on Gracie, especially after that wonderful extract that you just read. Tell me about her. Like, were you living vicariously through this wonderful woman who said all of those things that no one is supposed to say? Tell us a bit more about her.
Yeah, it was funny actually, because when I was kind of creating that character and decided, and I was thinking what could be her job, and, you know, that's always, for some reason, that's always a hard one. You know, picking the occupation of your characters is like, it's so defining, and it's so tricky, and I often struggle with it. But in this case, I remembered that I toyed with the idea of becoming a wedding celebrant at some point.
Did you?
I know, it's so silly because, well, you know, when I was in my kind of 20s and early 30s, you know, I kind of did a bunch of different things, including, you know, I was a cameraman for a while, and then for a long time I was just like a TV extra. And
a private detective? I read that you were a private detective, Steve. I can't believe it. I just found that out as well.
that's a short, boring story, so I'll
save
it.
Okay, forget that.
And at the same time, when my friend Anton got married, I remember he like asked me to be the best man at his wedding, and then I did a fairly good speech, and then I did a speech, and somebody else asked me to MC their wedding, and I did a speech at that wedding, and then somebody else asked me, you can write sort of short humorous things, people kind of like that, and so somebody else asked me, and then I was like, no, I don't want to speak at any more weddings, but then when I was thinking, God, what other jobs could I do, I thought, oh, maybe a wedding celebrant, that seems pretty easy, so I looked up, they had some courses at TAFE, but I ultimately decided that I would find, you know, standing up in front of strangers like on the most important days of their lives, so they think, it would be too stressful, so I didn't do it. But I did remember that when it came to creating the character of Gracie, so I got to write some of the sermons that I perhaps would have given in a parallel universe.
The sermons are unbelievable. Like, they're the absolute best speeches that you can kind of, I mean, it really is all of the things that you think in that kind of scenario, but no one would ever say, which I so loved. Yeah. So she must have been fun to write.
Yeah, really fun to write. I mean, all the characters were kind of fun to write, because the other character, Owen, it was like I really wanted to just like have a villain in this book, like an actual old school antagonist. So, yeah, that was also fun.
So, Owen, can you tell us a bit about Owen, just for background for people who haven't read the book, and a little bit about what he does? Because, again, I don't think it's a spoiler to introduce him and what happens in the early stages.
So basically, Gracie and Angus have kind of been married, I can't remember how long, maybe a couple of years. They're in the house that Gracie bought. And one morning, Owen knocks on the door and says that he grew up in the house that they are now living in, when he is also dying, and he would very much like to come in and die in his childhood bedroom, just basically spend his final days in the house he grew up in. And that's and Gracie and Angus agree to it.
Yeah, and he's a malevolent character, isn't he? As you said, he's a villain. He really is.
Yeah, he's a doctor. He's a doctor, and he's kind of he's a real like curmudgeon, you know. And he's not happy because he is dying. And so yeah, so he's basically offered to give Gracie and Angus kind of everything he owns, basically leaving his apartment and his car and some stocks and some money to them if they agree to this deal.
And I mean, for everyone listening, you can clearly hear that this is very funny, this novel. And it's funny, part of the reason it's so funny is because Steve's so astute in his writing, and the humour has elements of truth and like painfully truthful elements to it. Ron Charles in the Washington Post, I like this expression, he said, clever lines drop down on these pages like flowers thrown on a casket. And there are constant funny one-liners and aphorisms that become a style. And it felt even more playful and more free and hammed up or even slapstick at times. Though the unusual thing, like I said in the intro, was that it is moving. Like you become really attached to these characters and the kind of madness of their existences. So did that style, those kind of, did it just happen like that as you were writing it? Or was it something that that you thought you deliberately wanted to do when you kind of were embarking upon it?
Yeah, I mean, the style that comes out is, well, certainly like the kind of humor is just something that comes when, you know, when I, because I still write by hand, and so it's still like when the pen hits the page and I'm trying to write a sentence, or, you know, I'm usually like, I focus on scene, you know, I kind of go scene by scene. And so, yeah, that comes, but I have a tendency, what I do is I kind of do it like sculpting, like I override it and then I kind of whittle it down. Mm. And look, that's kind of the work of it, is that, and also it's a combination of my, disparate passions, which is like, I really love telling stories. I really like, thinking philosophically or psychologically. I like creating the characters, and you want the characters to be real. I mean, I definitely have to tone down the humor to make, to make the characters believable. And, you know, so that's kind of something that comes out of a process of editing.
Mm. And making them believable in the most unbelievable kind of mad hat situations, which is really interesting too, isn't it?
Yeah, you just have to make them, they just still have to be humans. And so even humans in, no matter what absurdity is happening, they just have to kind of react, you know, within the, you know, within the way their character would react, you know, in any other circumstances. So I like kind of stories or plots that are dictated by the character's action. So it's like the character leads sort of plot around by the nose kind of thing.
And Steve, why the afterlife? And tell me where the novel came from. I didn't ask you that essential question in the beginning, but what was the catalyst for it?
You know, it's really hard. The true answer, I mean, there's like 7 answers I could give you. It might be 9, but I mean, I could give you a few, right? So I won't give you all 9 answers, but one answer is, in 1999, I went to the movies and I saw the movie Magnolia, and then when I walked out of it, you know, it's a story that jumps from character to character, And when I walked out of it, I remember thinking, oh, it'd be fun to write a story where you go from character to character, but then one of those characters dies, but then you keep going from character to character and follow them into the afterlife. And that was a story that idea just kind of sat in my head for like 17 years. Yeah, another answer is almost all my stories begin with kind of, you know, an inciting incident, I guess. So like I have kind of premises. For instance, with this book, the premise of a character coming to the door to say that he's dying and he would like to live in the house, when I sort of was telling that story and realizing where it was going to go and that there would be a murder and a death, I wanted the story to continue. That's when I kind of married those two ideas. And then there is a third, like a third one might is the, like the thematic one, which is I wanted to write this kind of third book in this loose trilogy of fear. So my first book is about the fear of death, and the second book was about the fear of life and suffering. And then this book, I wanted to be about the fear of the opinions of other people. And I thought how it'd be kind of interesting to really explore these kind of, you know, how persistent these fears are by seeing what happens if you take kind of death off the table at some point, you know, just sort of see what persists beyond the grave. So those are kind of some of the things. And then it's sort of like if you asked me to describe a friend of mine and I told you about the night of his conception, it really wouldn't tell you anything about that friend. So like, the initial idea is just kind of like a dream I had once, and I started writing for whatever reason. I can see it now because I've started writing another book. So now I know that I had my new book that I've started is just, it starts from a single scene. But I'm sure if you ask me in 5 years, like, where did the book come from? I'll have 10 other answers.
So just in terms of the actual writing of it, was it something that you really enjoyed? Was it a pleasurable experience? Was it kind of grueling and difficult with this last book? Is it the same with all of your books? Like, is the new books a kind of a similar writing experience, or are they very much their own personalities and it kind of different experiences of writing?
The only difference, I think, is that I kind of throw away less than I used to, but I'm lucky in that I find writing really pleasurable and I enjoy it from beginning to end, really. The only thing I don't like, the only thing which really shits me is how long it takes me, and the fact that every day, like there's sort of, you know, I can count on one hand the amount of like writing days where I finished that day and felt really satisfied.
Right.
So that's why it's like, you know, having a job or, you know, doing something else is, you know, even going and posting a letter at the post office is really satisfying, because writing is so unsatisfying because you never really complete the task, because the task is a book, and it takes sort of years to complete that task. So you don't really get you don't get job satisfaction in that way, but the actual kind of conceiving and writing some fun pages and like that's, I really, I enjoy it.
And I remember once in New York, actually, I ran into you in a cafe and you were working there. Are you still kind of cafe hopping, or are you working at home?
I still occasionally, I do a little bit, but not as much as I used to. So I like work at home. I still move around a lot physically. Like, I kind of write at the kitchen table, write in bed, write on the couch, write in the yard. I've got a front porch here. So I like to move around.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, just what you were saying about those different kind of themes within your books overall, the connections between them, the kind of dealing with those big themes of life and death and really the absurdity of being human. I think that's definitely a connection from my perspective and many others. And it was interesting recently because I read this great piece by Vivian Gornick. Did you read it when she was reviewing Jeff Dyer's new book in The Atlantic?
Yeah, I read about half of it. I was on my phone, so I didn't get to the whole thing.
Oh, right. Well, she said, I'll just give a little recap. She said, most writers of books have only one story to tell. It's the one wrapped around a piece of emotional wisdom the author has made his or her own. If the writers are any good at what they do, the story deepens with each book that is written. If they are less good, the story will simply repeat itself at the same level at which it originally took shape. In time, the work of the better writer will come to feel enriched by the clear renewal of lived experience, while the work of the lesser one will come to seem even more reduced. I hold this truth to be self-evident for the writers of fiction and non-fiction. And I thought about that because I thought there is that emotional wisdom in your book and you are unbelievably good at what you do. And it feels like that to me. It feels like the story kind of deepens with each book. It almost feels like they're all a conversation with each other. Is that how you see them?
Yeah, I definitely see them as linked in some way, but kind of extending out, covering kind of more and more about. I mean, I suppose, you know, I sort of have said in the past, and you know, and I just said then they're about fear, but I really like to write about human motivation and human behavior.
Yeah.
So that's what I feel like is my kind of project that I feel like I'm just getting closer in a way. So I do feel like it's deepening, and I kind of have an idea of the next three books I want to write, and it is kind of each one of that is kind of getting into another aspect of that, and hopefully gets more and more close to nailing down why we act like we do.
Can you give us any more details about the one you're working on now? Or is that, I mean, you have it obviously just shared quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, this one, I mean, I'm kind of am doing, yeah, I mean, if this one was like, if these three books were about fear, the next three are kind of going to be really about consciousness. Mm. So I'm just kind of, yeah, I'm writing a lot about that. Yeah, it's kind of, at the moment, it's sort of a, yeah, there's consciousness and artificial intelligence and midlife crisis, and it's a sort of a small domestic kind of story that takes place over about a year. That's all I'll give you.
Ah, intriguing. And Steve, how does your fiction fit in with your screenwriting and what you've been doing in LA for different shows?
Well, I can't do the two things simultaneously. So, I mean, the screenwriting I feel is as different as if I was, you know, just working in a cafe or something like that. Like it's just, it feels like it's just, it's a day job and it's a way to do something different and to get out of my bedroom. Yeah, it's, I mean, I found the experience really fun, and I hope to be doing like more of it when I move back to Sydney. But it's as distinct, you know, it has nothing, I don't even, like, I just don't see it in the same world of writing. It's firstly because so far in my experience, I'm talking about two shows and that's the breadth of my experience, but the job is sort of 90% a brainstorming job rather than a writing job, and 10% a writing job. And so, you know, you're just spending a lot of time talking with other writers about story and character, and you know, I love that kind of thing. That's what I like to talk about. So it's really fun, and you sit around a table and you're all just like snacking all the time and putting on too much weight. But I mean, but then I did, you know, and then I've done a Zoom version of it, which was, I hated doing it because it didn't get me out of my room and it didn't give me the social life that I wanted. Yeah, it's a decent thing to do.
Have you found that it's a generous place, the writer's room, or is it the loudest person there or the person who's most charismatic, or is it literally the best ideas get up in your opinion? I mean, or I guess it could be a bit random as well.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, I've only had two experiences of two different rooms, and My experience has been everyone's like sort of genuinely, you know, it's very polite and people are generous with each other and, you know, you've got to like not blabber on too much or, but no, I think it's, yeah, it is the best ideas, but it's also if they're the kind of right kind of environments, you feel comfortable saying really shitty ideas and don't feel bad about it, you know, because you can't be embarrassed about saying, oh, what if the character was an elephant and everyone like, no, that sucks. And you're like, oh, all right. You've just got to feel comfortable and everyone's got to feel comfortable. And I've been lucky so far in that the rooms that I were in, everyone was like really lovely and nice. And yeah, I'm sure I've definitely heard nightmare stories, but I'm too old to like be sort of suffer in that kind of nightmare scenario. I don't care enough.
Mm. Let's go all the way back, Steve. And I think a lot of people listening would be curious about how you started out your career, but I want to go straight into the hard time. What about the period where you first were trying to get published? Did you get a lot of rejections? Can you share some of them for us?
So I was just weirdly, like I really didn't know anything about the publishing industry. My experience of writing my first book was I had been living in various countries. I didn't read a lot of very contemporary fiction. So I just kind of read a lot of classics, but also, you know, maybe some things from decades past. And then when I finished the book, I didn't really know what else to do other than pick the books off my own bookshelf that were by and send it to their editors. So that's what I did. It's like I picked a bunch of books off the bookshelf and then went, well, who published this? And then, you know, made a little list. And they weren't necessarily in Australia. I sent it to editors in like London and New York. And I remember my first version of A Fraction of the Whole was about 1,000 pages. So I printed out like various versions of 1,000 pages and then spent lots of money mailing them like internationally to these various publishers, like completely cold, obviously. And then I got a bunch of rejections. One of the rejections was kind of on the fence. And so she was an editor and she kind of wrote to me like and said, look, if you cut it down, I'll take another look. And then I'd had enough rejections that I thought, well, look, maybe I should. So I took another look at my book and then realized there was a character that just didn't really belong in the story. And I just cut him out wholesale and just like lost 300 pages by doing so. And then I sent it out again, but I didn't send it back to that woman.
Even though she was the only one who'd shown you some kind of interest in that. That's interesting that you didn't.
Yeah, I don't know. But I remember that then it became very random. My sister met I was sending it to agents, not publishers. So these were all agent responses. And then I remember then my sister met a writer at a party. And that writer.
So that would have been harder to find, can I just say, like, because finding the books I can see on your shelf, but then actually finding agents, that's hard to know the good agents, isn't it? It's also hard.
Yeah, I mean, like, so I just, that, but Google, I mean, it wasn't that hard to find. you just Google them. Okay. It's like, who represents this author?
That's true.
But then, so then, yeah, my sister met a writer at a party and was like, hey, my brother wrote a book and is looking for an agent. And that writer said, oh, well, I can ask my friend who's a publisher, like who he might recommend, just send him the book and he can maybe recommend an agent. This was a guy at Random House in New York and he read it and he's like, I want to publish this.
So I had
a publisher.
That must have been a big moment, was it, for you, like when you heard that?
Oh yeah, that was definitely. And so I didn't have an agent at that point. So that's how it started.
And then did you end up getting an agent afterwards, or what happened there?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, I basically called the only agent that hadn't gotten back to me and rejected me yet and said, hi, I sent you my manuscript a while ago. I don't think you've gotten to it yet, but I already have an offer from Random House in New York. And she wrote back and said, I'll represent you.
Yeah. So, is that handy 10%?
Yeah.
Now, Steve, in terms of the experience of publishing all of those different books, has it been about 7 years between every book? How long has it been?
Yeah, it has worked out to be 7 years. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in between time, you're doing this screenwriting, but every day you're working on your book. Do you have that kind of schedule or...?
Yeah, I try to. I try to work. You know, if I'm not doing the screenwriting, which does, you know, I've also sort of, I co-wrote a screenplay with someone, and so I have done some other projects as well.
What's happened with that screenplay?
We just found producers for it, so they're about to go out with it.
And what about the theatrical production, Steve? Can you tell me a bit about them?
The theatrical production? Oh, you mean my doomed play?
Yes. Tell me what happened, because there was that play some time ago that I remember you speaking about.
Oh, yeah.
Was it doomed? I didn't know it was doomed.
Well, it never really happened. Yeah, I wrote a play somewhere after A Fractional Whole and before Quicksand. And when I was in New York, I found a director who was really keen, and she set up these readings, and we had
extraordinary readings with incredible people, weren't there?
Yeah, we had like a reading with like Ralph Fiennes, and another one with Kevin Kline and Holly Hunter and Cynthia Nixon.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, ultimately no one committed to doing it.
I can't believe Sydney Theatre is not banging on your door, or Belvoir.
Well, yeah, I've decided to, I might turn that play into like a piece of fiction. So I'm just leaving that at the moment.
And sorry, I cut you off. You were saying Cynthia Nixon.
Oh, yeah. So she read one of them, and then she decided she wanted to try and be the director of it. And then, yeah, then she organized like Holly Hunter to read for it. And then, so we had to really decide. It was kind of near misses. And so, yeah, I got my hopes up about 7 to 10 times, and then just, yeah, it just vanished.
Again, the 7 to 10.
Everything happens 7 to 10 times in my life.
One last question. I'm just curious about the books that you're reading and other writers you might suggest who somehow, because I think it's quite a rare thing, who do humour really well in that kind of astute way. And I think it's very rare the way you write humour, but are there people that you admire in that world who do it really well?
I don't, despite writing kind of humorous books, I don't really read a lot of books like that. Maybe because I don't really find, I mean, I kind of like the European pessimists who are, you know, very Beckett kind of things, which are funny in their own dark way, but not certainly in the way that I am, that I feel that my books are. But I recently came across Charles Portis, who is most well known, he's an American writer, most well known for his Western that he wrote, True Grit, which became really famous, and they made two movies out of it. But his other books are just weird and hilarious. My favorite of his is called Dog of the South. And they're just kind of very rambly, weird novels that have just like long conversations between sort of very kind of eccentric characters. Really, really fun. Two Serious Ladies by Jane Bowles is a book that I love a lot. And they're kind of really funny. That's a really funny book. One of my favorite books that I reread a lot is Damon Galgut, who he won the Booker Prize last year, but he has this one book called In a Strange Room, which is just, I think it was three pieces of writing that he wrote and just sort of stuck them together. But it's really brilliant.
Oh, thank you so much for those recommendations. And thank you for this conversation today, Steve. It's been so lovely having a chat.
Yeah, it's been fun.
It really has. And for everyone listening, make sure you track down Steve's new book, Here Goes Nothing, that is absolutely brilliant. It is hilarious. It's touching. It did make me cry at the end. It was really moving. So get a copy at your local bookshop. And if you haven't read Steve's A Fraction of the Whole and Quicksand, make sure you read them too. Thanks so much, Steve. And I can't wait for you to come back to Sydney.
Yeah, I'll see you soon.